The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the January-February 2018 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, titled 1968, The Year That Shattered America. On today's program, we'll start with an article from the prologue section, titled Girl Power, How A Wrinkle in Time Liberated Young Adult Literature, by Natalie Escobar. When Lena Roy was 7 years old, her teacher read the first chapter of A Wrinkle in Time aloud to her second grade class. After school, Lena ran to her grandmother's house, which was around the corner from her school on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, to finish the book on her own. She curled up in bed and devoured it. She felt just like the hot-headed, stubborn heroine Meg Murray, and took comfort in the fact that a flawed adolescent girl could save the world. It was almost like your permission to be a real person. Roy says, you don't have to be perfect. Millions of other adolescent girls and boys have had the same liberating discovery while reading A Wrinkle in Time. What's different about Roy is that her grandmother happened to be Madeline Lingle, the book's author, who revolutionized serious young adult fiction with her clever mashup of big ideas, science fantasy, and adventure, and a geeky girl action hero way ahead of her time. Since its 1962 publication, Wrinkle has sold more than 10 million copies and been turned into a graphic novel, an opera, and two films, including an ambitious adaptation from the director Ava DuVernay, due out in March. The book also kicked open the door for other bright young heroines and the amazingly lucrative franchises that they appear in, from whip-smart Hermione Granger in the Harry Potter books to lethal Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games. Leonard Marcus, author of the Lingle biography, Listening for Madeline, says Wrinkle, quote, set the stage for the reception of Harry Potter in this country, unquote. Previously, he says, science fiction and fantasy were suitable for high-end British authors like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien in Britain, but in the States were relegated to pulp magazines and drugstore paperbacks. Then came Lingle, a 41-year-old writer who spent 3 months in 1959 writing the hard-to-categorize story that would become A Wrinkle in Time. While Meg Murray and her companions travel through time and space to save her father, a scientist trapped by evil forces on a distant planet, readers had to wrap their minds around the fifth dimension, the horrors of conformity, and the power of love. Lingle believed that literature should show youngsters they were capable of taking on the forces of evil in the universe, not just the everyday pains of growing up. If it's not good enough for adults, she once wrote, it's not good enough for children. Publishers hated it. Every firm her agent turned to rejected the manuscript. One advised to do a cutting job on it by half. Another complained, it's something between an adult and juvenile novel. Finally, a friend advised Lingle to send it to one of the most prestigious houses of all, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. John Farrar liked the manuscript. A test reader he gave it to, though, was unimpressed. I think this is the worst book I have ever read. It reminds me of The Wizard of Oz. Yet FSG acquired it, and Hal Versel, the book's editor, talked it up in letters he sent to reviewers. It's distinctly odd, extremely well written, he wrote to one, and is going to make greater intellectual and emotional demands on 12 to 16-year-olds than most formula fiction for this age group. When it debuted, not only was Wrinkle widely praised, quote-unquote wholly absorbing, said the New York Times Book Review, but it won the Newbery Medal, the most important award in children's lit. The almost universal reaction of children to this year's winning book, by wanting to talk about it to each other and to elders, shows the deep desire to understand as well as to enjoy, says Newbery Committee member Ruth Gagliardo. American publishers, initially resistant to genre bending, soon were producing their own teen epics, including Lloyd Alexander's Newbery-winning Chronicles of Prydain books and Ursula K. Le Guin's Earthsea series. L'Engle went on to write more than 40 books, including works of nonfiction and poetry, though none was as acclaimed as Wrinkle. None was as controversial either. Libraries and schools frequently banned the novel because of its entanglements with religion. In one passage, Jesus Christ is compared to Shakespeare, Einstein, and the Buddha, a heretical notion to some authorities. On the American Library Association's list of most frequently challenged for the 1990s, Wrinkle was number 23. Among the countless girls changed forever by L'Engle's book was Diane Duane, who first read it as a 10-year-old in 1962. She'd consumed all the science fiction and fantasy at her local library, but had never encountered anyone like Meg. Finally, Duane recalls, here was a girl character being treated as if her take on what was going on around her, her analysis and her emotional reactions to the things that were happening around her, were real and were worth paying attention to. Today, Duane is hailed as the best-selling author of So You Want to Be a Wizard, and other titles in her Young Wizards fantasy series, which features a young female protagonist, Nita. All the time, L'Engle's shadow, and a very bright shadow, it has to be said, was lying over that work for me, she says. It would have been very difficult for me to do that writing without thinking about her a lot. Lena Roy, who is a writing teacher in New York and the co-author of an upcoming biography of her grandmother, becoming Madeline, doesn't remember L'Engle ever calling herself a feminist, though she was proud of being what Roy calls a quote-unquote trailblazing woman. L'Engle had spent her years at Smith College editing the campus literary magazine alongside Betty Friedan, who later penned The Feminine Mystique. L'Engle herself suggested it was easy to make her protagonist a strong girl. I'm a female, she once said. Why would I want to give all my best ideas to a male? Now the movie adaptation of Wrinkle is poised to make L'Engle's creation even more groundbreaking. DuVernay, the first woman of color to direct a live-action film with a production budget over $100 million, intentionally cast non-white actors in lead roles. Storm Reid will play Meg, and Derek McCabe will play her younger brother Charles. In 1962, it was radical to see a young girl in charge. Now a new generation of black girls and boys can see themselves on screen and dream of saving the world. Continuing in the prologue section, we'll move on to an article titled Muses of Modern Art by Tiffany Y. Aitz. How a celebrated portraitist's glittering image of black women upends tradition. What does it mean to redefine art history? For Micheline Thomas, a luminary of the contemporary art world who specializes in dazzling collage portraits, it means reclaiming canonized images of beauty and reinterpreting them. Her take on Edouard Manet's celebrated 1863 canvas, Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe, The Luncheon on the Grass, in which two formerly dressed men lounge in a wooden scene with a nude woman, is the bold image, which she titles Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe's Les Trois Femmes Noires, The Three Black Women. This 10-by-24-foot collage, part of a new group exhibition at the Seattle Art Museum, depicts the subjects in a mosaic of vibrant colors, fragmented shapes, rhinestones, and glittered afros. These women are so grounded and perfectly comfortable in their own space, says Katerina Menchada, a curator at the museum. While we might be looking at them, they are also sizing us up. For the past decade, Thomas, an African-American Yale-trained artist in her 40s who lives in New York City, has concentrated on creating portraits in various formats of black women, her muses, she calls them. This gesture in itself challenges conventional notions of femininity, sexuality, and blackness in art history, especially given the complicated role of black bodies in 19th century paintings. Often working from her own studio photographs of models, Thomas has a singular aesthetic combining memories of her 70s childhood, pop culture, and classical art in large-scale works that often seem to draw on chic blaxploitation films like Gordon Parks' Shaft. Her muses, adorned in lush fabrics, unapologetic bold prints, and sometimes nude, mirror Pam Grier-esque heroines, while also subverting the motif of the odalisque or courtesan. By portraying the real women with their own unique history, beauty, and background, I'm working to diversify the representations of Black women in art, Thomas tells Smithsonian. Outside of academic art circles and the gallery scene, Thomas is kind of a Renaissance rock star in her own right. She has created a commissioned portrait for the R&B artist Solange Knowles, directed an introspective HBO documentary, Happy Birthday to Beautiful Woman, and was herself the subject of a portrait by the famed painter Kehinde Wiley. Thomas's artwork, which critics have called post-Black and post-feminist because of its nuanced rebelliousness, is helping to generate American art's next wave, which will be more culturally diverse. What's happening in art and history right now is the validation and agency of the Black female body, she says. We do not need permission to be present. Next, we have an article in the prologue section titled Books of Revelation by Joe Marchant. A new project to scan manuscripts at the world's oldest monastery is exposing amazing ancient texts. Last summer, Julia Rossetto, a specialist in ancient text at the University of Vienna, was on a train home to Pordenone in northern Italy when she switched on her laptop and opened a series of photographs of a manuscript known as Arabic New Finds 66. It is no ordinary manuscript. In antiquity, it was common practice when parchment supplies were limited to scrape the ink from old manuscripts with chemicals or pumice stones and reuse them. The resulting double text is called a palimpsest, and the manuscript Rossetto was studying contains several pages whose Christian text, a collection of saints' lives written in 10th century Arabic, hid a much older text beneath in faintest Greek. Nothing was known about what this undertext contained. Rossetto, a PhD student, was given the images as an afterthought when an older scholar complained that reading them was beyond his failing eyesight. But these were no ordinary photographs, either. They were taken using a state-of-the-art technique known as multispectral imaging, or MSI, in which each page of a text is photographed many times while illuminated by different colors and wavelengths of light, and then analyzed using computer algorithms to find a combination that most clearly distinguishes the two layers of text. As Rossetto's train sped through the Austrian Alps, she flipped between the images, adjusting the contrast, brightness, and hue to minimize the appearance of the Arabic overtext while picking out tiny Greek letters, each around 3 millimeters tall. The style of the script suggested that it was probably written in Egypt in the 5th or 6th century, and Rossetto expected another Christian text. Instead, she began to see names from mythology, Persephone, Zeus, Dionysus. The lost writing was classical Greek. There was no internet connection on the train, but as soon as she got home, Rossetto rushed to her computer to check her transcription against known classical text. I tried different combinations and there was nothing, she recalls. I thought, wow, this is something new. In his poem, Endymion, based on a Greek myth about a shepherd beloved by the moon goddess Selene, John Keats paid special tribute to the enduring power of superior works of art. A thing of beauty is a joy forever, he wrote. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness. Surely to uncover lost poetry from an ancient civilization from which we draw so many of our literary traditions is as exciting as unearthing any material treasure. And this promise reaches beyond aesthetics. When classical Greek literature was rediscovered during the European Renaissance, it remade Western civilization and planted seeds that still shape our lives today. Thomas Jefferson's ideas about the pursuit of happiness were sparked by the Greek philosophers. Suffragists were inspired by Euripides' heroine Medea. Like finding an old photograph of a long-dead relative, discovering a lost piece of text can help us glimpse ourselves and the people who came before us. Rosetto's text is just one of hundreds whose recovery was recently announced by researchers participating in a project to decipher the secrets of a unique treasury in the Sinai Desert in Egypt. A monastery called St. Catherine's hosts the world's oldest continually operating library, used by monks since the 4th century. In addition to printed books, the library contains more than 3,000 manuscripts, accumulated over the centuries and remarkably well preserved by the dry and stable climate. The monks at St. Catherine's were particularly fond of reusing older parchment for their religious texts. Today, the library holds at least 160 palimpsests, likely the largest collection in the world. But the ancient scribes did their job frustratingly well. In most cases, the texts underneath were hidden and until now thought lost. St. Catherine's, a community of 20 or 25 or so Greek Orthodox monks at the foot of Mount Sinai, transcends history, and that ancient traditions live on into the present day. The first mention of its written collection comes from an account by a 4th century pilgrim named Egeria, who described how the monks read biblical passages to her when she visited a chapel built to commemorate Moses' burning bush. In the 6th century, the Byzantine emperor Justinian protected the chapel with hefty granite walls. 1,500 years later, they stand intact. As you approach it, the sand-colored monastery, nestled low on the mountain, looks humble and timeless, like something made of the desert. Inside is a warren of stone steps, arches, and alleyways. A square bell tower draws the eye upward toward the jagged mountain peaks above. Despite the rise and fall of surrounding civilizations, life here has changed remarkably little. The monks' first daily worship still begins at 4 a.m. Central to St. Catherine's, now as in Egeria's time, is the library, and the person in charge of it is the Reverend Justin Sinaites, who wears a long gray beard and the black robes traditional to his faith. Born in Texas and brought up Protestant, Father Justin, as he prefers to be known, discovered Greek Orthodoxy while studying Byzantine history at the University of Texas at Austin. After converting to the faith, he spent more than 20 years living at a monastery in Massachusetts, where, as head of the monastery's publications, he became adept at using computer and desktop publishing technology. In 1996, Father Justin moved to St. Catherine's, and when the monastery's abbot decided to digitize the library's manuscript collection to make it available to scholars around the world, Father Justin was asked to lead the effort. "When I reached Father Justin in Egypt by telephone last fall, he was thoughtful and articulate and gave the impression, like the monastery itself, of existing on a plane outside of worldly limitations. Asked to describe the physical size of the library, he at first seemed baffled. 'I don't think in those terms,' he said. During our conversation, he routinely answered my questions with stories rooted hundreds of years in the past. Because the library alone was allowed to access the library vaults, the manuscripts were always brought to him one by one, their darkened edges and drops of candle wax, testament to centuries of wear and use. 'I was so eager to go in and see everything else, and I couldn't,' he says. 'Then about 10 years ago, they made me the librarian.' Finally, he could explore the full collection, including the palimpsests. The problem was that there didn't seem much hope of reading them. But in 2008, researchers in the United States announced the completion of a 10-year project to use multispectral imaging to read lost works by the Greek mathematician Archimedes, hidden beneath the liturgy of a 13th-century Byzantine prayer book. Father Justin, who already knew members of the group, asked if they would come to St. Catherine's. The resulting collaboration, known as the Sinai Palimpsest Project, is directed by Michael Phelps of the California-based Early Manuscripts Electronic Library, a nonprofit research group that works with universities such as UCLA and other institutions to digitize historical source materials and make them accessible for study. Beginning in 2011, Phelps and other members of the project made 15 visits to the monastery over 5 years, each time driving for hours through the Sinai Desert, the site of ongoing conflict between Egyptian security forces and Islamic militants. Many of the palimpsests come from a cache of about 1,100 manuscripts found in a tower of the monastery's north wall in 1975, and consist of damaged leaves left behind when the library was moved in the 18th century, then hidden for protection after an earthquake. They are tinder dry, falling to pieces, and often nibbled by rats. Father Justin brought each palimpsest out of to be photographed by the project's chief camera operator, Damanios Kostakis, who used a 50-megapixel camera custom-built in California. Photographing each page took about 7 minutes, the shutter clicking repeatedly while the page was illuminated by infrared, visible, and ultraviolet lights that ran across the color spectrum. The researchers toyed with different filters, lighting from strange angles, anything they could think of that might help pick out details from a page's surface. Then a group of imaging specialists based in the United States stacked the images for each page to create a digital cube and designed algorithms, some based on satellite imaging technology, that would most clearly recognize and enhance the letters beneath the overtext. "You just throw everything you can think of at it," Kostakis says, "and pray for the best." Perhaps someone was listening. Last year, the monastery and the Early Manuscripts Electronic Library announced at a conference in Athens that over the five-year period, they had imaged 6,800 pages from 74 palimpsests, which will be made accessible online by UCLA sometime in early 2018. So far, their work has revealed more than 284 erased texts in 10 languages, including classical, Christian, and Jewish texts dating from the 5th century until the 12th century. The collection is being compared to the greatest manuscript discoveries of the 20th century, including the Nag Hammadi codices of Egypt and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Already, as a part of the Sinai Palimpsest Project, some 24 scholars from across Europe, the United States, and the Middle East are poring over these texts. One of the most exciting finds is a palimpsest made up of scraps from at least 10 older books. The manuscript is a significant text in its own right, the earliest known version of the Christian Gospels in Arabic, dating from the 8th or 9th century. But what's underneath, Phelps predicts, will make it a celebrity manuscript. Several previously unknown medical texts, dating to the 5th or 6th century, including drug recipes, instructions for surgical procedures, including how to remove a tumor, and references to other tracts that may provide clues about the foundations of ancient medicine. Another fragment of this palimpsest contains a beautiful two-page illustration of a flowering plant from an herbal or guide to medicinal plants, which Nigel Wilson, a classicist at Oxford who is studying the text, believes may be the work by Critias, physician to the poison-obsessed Anatolian king Mithridates in the 1st century BC. Copies of his drawings made as late as 600 years after his death survive, but until now we only knew his writings through quotations by the 1st century physician Dioscorides. "This is the first scrap we've got of an actual manuscript of his work," says Wilson. From the same palimpsest, Agamemnon Salikas, director for the Center for History and Paleography in Athens, recovered the earliest known versions of classic texts by Hippocrates, the father of Western medicine, which are 4 centuries older than any copies previously known. Other fragments include bits as unexpected as a version of the ancient Greek adventure story called Apollonius of Tyre, which is now the oldest known Latin translation and the earliest with illustrations by 500 years. Julia Rossetto, who discovered her own celebrity manuscript aboard a train ride home to Italy, is still piecing together the implications of her find. So far, she has deciphered 89 lines of text, many of them incomplete, and learned that they belong to a previously unknown poem written in Greek hexameter, the same scheme used for Homer's epics. They tell of a myth in which Dionysus, the young son of Zeus and Persephone, sits on a throne as a group of murderous titans try to win his confidence. Rossetto also found the number 23 in the text, which she believes denotes a book number, hinting, she says, that the lines might come from the Rhapsodies, attributed to the ancients by the mythical poet Orpheus and collected in 24 books, like Homer's poems. The Rhapsodies were widely studied until at least the 6th century, but are today known only through fragmentary quotations by later philosophers. The secrets of each individual manuscript will keep scholars busy for years to come. Yet, there's an even bigger discovery emerging from this project. Beyond the many textual revelations, the surprising history of St. Catherine's itself. Rapp, who also serves as the Sinai Project's scholarly director, has been especially intrigued to learn what the palimpsests reveal about the process by which parchment were reused. In none of them is there an apparent relationship between the overtext and undertext, she says. Indeed, scattered pages from multiple older manuscripts in different languages were often brought together to make a new book. Rather than individual scribes selecting manuscripts to scrape clean for personal use, this suggests an organized production, perhaps even commercial circulation, of recycled parchment sheets. And the sheer variety of languages uncovered was entirely unexpected. Some of the texts are even helping to reconstruct lost languages, including Caucasian Albanian, spoken in an ancient kingdom in present-day Azerbaijan, and Christian Palestinian Aramaic, used by Christians in Palestine until the 13th century. Each surprise adds a piece to the puzzle. The discovery of two unknown Christian texts in the ancient language of Ge'ez suggests that Ethiopian monks, who were not thought to have had much contact with Sinai in antiquity, may once have practiced at the monastery. And one palimpsest, which Michelle Brown, a former curator at the British Library in London, describes as a Sinai sandwich, is remarkable for the relationship it suggests between four different layers of text. Its oldest layer was written in Greek at St. Catherine's. Next is an undertext in a Latin script used in Italy at the turn of the 7th century, then an 8th century Latin insular script, a style of writing pioneered by monks in Ireland that flourished in the British Isle. The top layer is an Arabic script written in St. Catherine's around the turn of the 10th century. This is a real breakthrough, a quote-unquote smoking gun, Brown says. Scholars have assumed that there was little contact between the Middle East and the West in the Middle Ages, before the Crusades. But Brown suspected from what she could already make out of the palimpsest and other fragments of St. Catherine's that this view was wrong. The layering of these scripts reveals that, by new imaging, supports her hunch. It's exceedingly unlikely that the pages were carried from Sinai to Rome, to Britain, and then back again. Instead, she says, monks from these distinct Western communities must have been working at St. Catherine's over the centuries. Put all of that together, and our view of this humble outpost is transformed. You might think of the Sinai Desert merely as a remote wilderness where the Jews wandered for decades after their escape from Egyptian slavery. But the diverse findings of the palimpsest offer stunning testimony to St. Catherine's role as a vibrant cosmopolitan center and a key player in the cultural history of East and West, where people of different languages and communities met and exchanged practices and intellectual traditions. It's a place where people made the effort to travel to, says Rapp, and they came from all over the world. For Father Justin, the project represents a remarkable opportunity to extend what he calls a living tradition at St. Catherine's, in which each manuscript is not only a holy object, but a tangible witness to visitors from the remote past. For centuries, the monastery's walls protected these manuscripts, but the political situation outside remains turbulent. Last spring, militants allied with ISIS killed a policeman a few hundred yards from its gates. Although Father Justin insists the danger isn't representative, he hopes the imaging project will help to protect the manuscript's treasures for centuries to come. That is our obligation and our challenge today. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.